Ok, donc on va reprendre pour la partie séminaire de cette session et je vais passer à l'anglais pour introduire notre orateur. So, we are very fortunate and I'm very grateful to have Darrell Schlom here. He came specially for this visit and seminar. So thank you very much, Darrell. As I'm sure most of you know, Darrell is really one of the world leaders in the material science of transition metal oxides and especially oxide heterostructures. He's an artist of MBE, and you've seen this in the sandwich picture earlier. Let me give you his full title. He's the Herbert Fisk Johnson Professor of Industrial Chemistry at Cornell University. Is that correct? He's also a member of the National Academy of Engineering and a fellow of the APS. Darrell did his PhD at Stanford University. Then I learned, looking at your webpage, that you went for a postdoc to Bednarz and Müller at IBM Zurich, just in the glorious days, just after discovery of ITC, I suppose. He had also a sabbatical visit at Augsburg, where, of course, Jochen Mannaert was before moving to Stuttgart. And you were first at Penn State and then moved to Cornell a few years ago. So he's going to give us some overview that he has entitled Thin Film Alchemy, and this is proper because he's really an alchemist creating new materials with these techniques.
Thank you, Antoine. And it's my pleasure to be here. It's hard to resist an invitation to come to Paris and enjoy a few beautiful days. In contrast to the last lecture, I would like to invite you to ask questions at any time. I'm not used to a class where students don't ask questions. So please, if you have a question, ask. What I want to describe is the powerful combination of theory with synthesis. So in my view, we've entered a new era of materials physics, one in which materials that have properties superior to any other are being developed with the aid of a computer. And it's really through a conversation between experimentalists and theorists. And I'll emphasize that in this talk. So by way of the title, I think it links really well to Professor George's view graph that you saw in an earlier lecture. And this is what I would call, you know, modern alchemy. Instead of the old tools of the alchemist, what we're using are what I would call thin film tools. So ways of achieving properties that access hidden ground states of materials. So not the energetically lowest ground state under normal conditions, but rather what's normally a metastable ground state that has higher energy, but that's being stabilized by the system. So that's the hidden ground state. And here I've shown, you know, a bunch of different systems as well as the tricks, and I'll say more about these tricks, but you might recognize some of these particular systems from the lectures that you've been hearing in the field of complex oxides. So in this talk, I want to start by describing this toolkit to unleash these hidden ground states. And that's in the thin film regime. And I'll give some examples. I'll start with examples in the ruthenates, where Professor George has given you an extensive background in these materials. And I'll be talking about both the infinite perovskite, the perovskite structure, like barium ruthenate, as well as some Ruddleston-Popper phases. So calcium, strontium, and barium, these very two-dimensional layered materials. I'll also talk about europium titanate, material that's multiferroic. In fact, it's the strongest material that's simultaneously ferroelectric and ferromagnetic at the same time. A very unusual ground state, and it's a hidden ground state. The stable ground state of europium titanate is paramagnetic No, it's anti-ferromagnetic and paraelectric at the same time. So it's doubly boring, as opposed to being ferromagnetic and ferroelectric at the same time with huge property coefficients. And then I'll also show you, also in the multi-ferroic regime, I'll show you a new material that utilizes all these tricks, and it's the world's strongest room temperature multiferroic. And again, I'd be happy to take questions should you have some. So you may have, you know, with this alchemy, I should say, you know, who it is that the great ideas have come from. And so in this talk, I want to acknowledge two key theorists, Craig Feeney. He and I started at Cornell on the same day, and his former advisor for his PhD, Karen Rabe. And I also want to acknowledge the people who actually did all the hard work and made the films. So the ruthenates that I'm going to show, the strontium ruthenate is from Carolina Adamo, the barium ruthenate is from Hanjong Paik, the calcium ruthenate is from Hari Nair, and then the room temperature multiferroic is from this combination of Julia Mundy, who not only grew many of the films, but also did all the TEM, as well as Charles Brooks, who did a lot of the film growth in that system together. Okay, and although I'm from a film growth group, we've been doing oxide MBE for 30 years now. We collaborate with theorists, as I already mentioned, as well as many experimentalists. And I'm going to highlight a lot of work from my close colleague Shen, Kyle Shen, for the ARPAs, so measuring the band structure on these materials, and that really relates closely to the theory, like you've been seeing in this class. Also seeing where the atoms are, so by electron microscopy. I know you've had a class in EELS. I'll be showing you some nice electron microscopy using that same technique. Magnetic measurements by a variety of technique, including synchrotron techniques, optical techniques, neutron diffraction. And then finally, a key aspect of doing this alchemy is straining the material utilizing new single crystal substrates. And we have a wonderful collaboration that's been going on for over a dozen years with this Institute for Crystal Growth in Berlin. Okay, so I know this is not a synthesis class, but if it were a synthesis class, you'd start off, you know, learning the principles of synthesis and how it's important to have Professor Gibbs on your side. You want thermodynamics on your side, want to be able to make stable phases. Another famous rule, particularly in the area of superconductivity, is Bernd Matthias's rule from Bell Labs. It has a number of rules, and perhaps the most infamous is to stay away from theorists, an interesting rule, but I'll show you his rules in a minute. And then Professor Pauling, when you're trying to make particularly inorganic structures, what structures are stable? What structures are you expected to form, so-called Pauling's rules? And when it comes to doing materials alchemy, what I want to stress in this lecture is that it's very important not only to know the rules, but it's key to be able to break the rules. And I'm going to show you, within limits, of course, but I'll show you examples of how breaking the rules unleashes these hidden ground states in the oxide systems. Especially the second rule. In my view, nothing could be more untrue than the second rule. Okay, so let's start with the first rule. First rule, Professor Gibbs. So the importance of having thermodynamics on your side when you're making a high-quality sample. We like to grow, you know, high-quality samples very slowly. So traditionally, if this is the phase that is the stable phase, then that's the one that you can make as a nice, large, perfect single crystal. And unfortunately, if this is the phase that has the superior properties, it's inaccessible. Okay, it's metastable. Now, an important way of breaking this rule is to really change the system. And this may at first seem unusual, but from a thin film perspective, what we do is we redefine the system. Instead of just being the phase that you're going after, let's say that we want to stabilize this phase, we change the system to be the combination of that phase and a substrate upon which it's grown. And by changing the system and deliberately introducing a substrate that has the same structural motif as the phase that you want to grow, you can make it so that this interface between this substrate and this phase has very low energy, whereas the phase that you don't want and that substrate has a very high energy. So that adds these additional terms, the additional surface energy associated with this interface, the additional strain energy, because these atoms do not match the underlying positions of the one underneath it. So in optimal systems, it's possible to make it so that you can grow a highly perfect sample at high temperature and have thermodynamics on your side by having a system that looks like this. And this was first appreciated by Praveen Chaudhary. He was my boss. Well, he was my boss's boss's boss when I was at IBM. He was the head of physical sciences at IBM. And he realized this back in the 80s. And it's the idea is to exploit the interfacial energy from the substrate. Here's a picture of Praveen. After his career at IBM, he went on to be the director of Brookhaven National Lab, but an eminent scientist. And in his beautiful paper, he was the first to appreciate the importance of combining a film of what you want to make with a substrate as a way to access these hidden ground states and to change the thermodynamic system so that this becomes the energetically stable system. We call this epitaxial stabilization. Now, the space that one can access becomes enormous. Not only do we have all the stable states of matter, putting together all these different oxides, but now you can imagine all these different metastable states. So to me, that's where it becomes really important to have this combination of theory and experiment together so that we can target a particular system, think of what single crystal substrate we're going to make to stabilize this desired state of matter. And I'll show you some examples in this talk of doing that. So let me start with such an example. So I'm going to start with the example of barium ruthenate over here. Okay. So on the top, I give several films that I'll be talking about in this lecture. And barium ruthenate is on the computer at least can have a perovskite structure. Its stable state is a perovskite related phase that's rhombohedral. And doesn't just have corner sharing octahedra like the perovskite structure does. So this phase of barium ruthenate has been stabilized in the past by pressure. So here I show you some results from John Goodenough. This is the stable phase of barium ruthenate. So you can see that in addition to having the corner sharing octahedra, it importantly has these edge sharing octahedra that give it a totally different structure, electronic structure, different properties. And then by applying pressure, what Professor Goodenough discovered was that he could access different polymorphs of barium ruthenate. So here at 3,000 atmospheres, 50,000 atmospheres, and then most recently, 180,000 atmospheres of pressure, this becomes the stable polymorph of barium ruthenate. And Goodenough measured that the huge change in electronic properties here, this one becomes ferromagnetic at about 60 Kelvin. Now, this ability to access these, what I would call again hidden ground states through pressure is one way of going about the synthesis, but it obscures what the electronic structure of the material really is. Because this material does not cleave. So how are you going to use a technique like ARPA's on it? And that's the advantage of the thin film approach. In the thin film approach, we don't have to cleave the material to do ARPA's. We can make a nice flat surface. And then without exposing that surface to air, we can do ARPAs on that surface. So here I'll preface this first with what the properties are. But here's an example of that same polymorph. And I deliberately chose this because to date, this is the polymorph that, a common question I get is, well, how high a pressure can you have in the thin film? I mean, it's really an ultra high vacuum that we make these things. But here's an example of a phase that we've stabilized that normally takes 180,000 atmospheres of pressure to stabilize. We've stabilized it by using an appropriate substrate. So we want to so we're using a cubic substrate of strontium titanate. And as long as the film is less than 5 unit cells thick, it forms this perovskite structure. Beyond that, it reverts to the lower phase structure. So we're using the interfacial energy to bias the system. If you make your film too thick, and this is a huge strain, this is 2.5% strain, make it too thick, it relaxes to the stable state. Nonetheless, here's angle integrated ARPAs, so this is photo emission, and a direct comparison between the electronic structure that's measured on the material with what's calculated by various different techniques. And also compared to strontium ruthenate. Here I show the transport of our films. So this is the barium ruthenate, okay, the perovskite polymorph. This is strontium ruthenate. We just heard in the last lecture how strontium ruthenate is an itinerant ferromagnet with a transition temperature about 160 Kelvin. And you can see that by the kink here in the transport. On the other hand, there is no kink in this barium ruthenate that we've made under strain. And you might say, well, why is that? You know, Professor Goodenough saw that it had a transition of about 60 Kelvin. Our film, on the other hand, is thin, and it's also highly strained. And so we're working to change the strain state, but our hypothesis is either the thinness or the strain is what is suppressing the ferromagnetism in the system. Here you can see in real time during growth the transition from the cubic perovskite phase to the lower energy polymorph. Okay. Let me come to the second rule.
Does this bulk barium ruthenium 3, once it's grown under pressure, can you then?
Yes.
You don't need pressure then. After
that's correct. So this is grown under pressure. These measurements are not made under pressure. Mm-hmm. So some stable phases you can make them under pressure, cool them down, release the pressure, and then it's kinetically trapped in that phase and you can measure its properties. In this case, it's polycrystal and it's powder and the material doesn't cleave. So you don't get the ARPAs, and I'll show you the ARP, I'll show you the angle resolved photo emission in just a second on this system. Okay, please.
You had something called 3C, which was the high pressure thing.
Yes.
And here it's called C-star, mm-hmm. Same thing. Oh no, that's your—
No, that's our film. That's our film, exactly. So we've stabilized the perovskite polymorph, but in our case, it's strained, so it's tetragonally distorted. Now, this second rule. Berndt Matthias, and in my view, you know, this is an outdated ivory tower attitude. But let me show you his famous rules. So these are via my theorist friends, okay? And your theorist friends. So Berndt Matthias was a discoverer of several superconductors, including niobium-310, of great importance practically. But he was an outspoken critic of theory. And I mentioned this down here at the bottom. And in my view, that ivory tower is completely outdated. Let me show you a different mode of operation that really changed my life. So I used to be, you know, 30 years ago, I was a lone fisherman. You know, casting my line in different directions, looking for an interesting material. And my life changed about a dozen years ago when I started to talk, not only talk to theorists, but listen to them. And here are some of my theorist friends. Maybe you'll recognize Nicholas Spaulding over here, Craig Feeney, Karen Rabe, Long Chen, Andy Millis. Examples of the theory that you'll see in the coming slides. And I would argue that it's important not to distrust theorists, but to team up directly with theorists and to provide them with useful feedback to their theory. So if you're an electronic structure theorist, what could be better than an experiment that provides you with the electronic structure on the theory that you've been calculating? Okay? That allows you to see, you know, what elements might be, you know, where it agrees well, where it doesn't agree well, what elements might be tweaked, and allows the experimentalist to navigate this incredible space of materials to find materials that have great properties. Okay, so I'll show you some examples of that. And the kind of feedback is, you know, not only electronic structure, which could be from angle resolved photo emission, which I know you had a lecture on from Andre a couple of lectures ago, could be spectroscopic imaging, scanning tunneling microscopy, and then, you know, where the atoms really are. So, you know, we make structures and we try to get the atoms in particular positions, but it's really important to see, are they in those positions, and then what the electronic structure is to connect the whole thing together. So I think, you know, what's key here is to team up with theorists and provide them with useful feedback. So I'll show you a bunch of examples of this. And I want to you know, show this key aspect of combining synthesis with something that can see the electronic structure. So at this technique of angle resolved photo emission as well as spectroscopic imaging STM, are very powerful techniques to reveal the electronic structure, macroscopically in the case of ARPAs or microscopically in the case of spectroscopic imaging STM. But in the universe of materials, those techniques have historically been applicable only to single crystal materials that cleave. And I would argue that's a very small space. So if you're thinking, you know, of bulk quantum materials, these are materials where you have Professor Gibbs on your side. And then you want the ones that are cleavable. It's an even smaller subset of those materials. Imagine instead a much larger universe of quantum materials, artificial quantum materials, where you can access materials that are metastable by combining it with a substrate and doing this process of epitaxial stabilization, or deliberately making multi-layers, playing the strain game, as I'll be talking about in a few minutes, juxtaposing ground states from a substrate versus the layer that you put on top of it, could give rise to polarization doping. Here I've given specific systems that have each one of these properties, dimensional confinement. It's a huge universe, and what you'd like to be able to do is to have guidance from theory and provide feedback on what the electronic structure is in those systems. And this is what's made possible by combining together a technique like ARPAs with a technique like MBE. So we can synthesize materials, they don't need to be cleaved. As long as you keep them clean in ultra-high vacuum, you can look at their electronic structure immediately after growth. And I'm proud to say that Kyle Shannon and I were the first in the world to combine oxide MBE with ARPAs, and that was over 5 years ago now. And in the meantime, we looked at over 1,000 different samples. So I'm going to show you some highlights of that work today. Now first, the technique. Molecular beam epitaxy, from a cartoon perspective, it's not rigorously true, but this is a zeroth order approximation. It's atomic spray painting. So what we do is we rain down atoms on top of a single crystal substrate. So here schematically is the single crystal substrate. And you can imagine different elemental spray cans in which we can control the order in which each one of these species reaches the surface to try to build up some structure. Now, in actuality, this technique occurs in a vacuum of extreme emptiness. So the pressure is less than a millionth of an atmosphere inside. And at those very low pressures, not only is it clean, but the mean free path is quite long. So many meters. So the elements, we heat an element up. So here, for example, is say titanium. It's hot. And the atoms that evaporate from this hot titanium have such a long mean free path that they don't scatter with any atoms, and they make the trajectory from the source all the way to the hot substrate without any scattering events. So we have a molecular beam, and we combine these molecular beams to do epitaxy, where, and I know that was also defined, I think it was in lecture number one, where the surface takes the shape of the underlying substrate. So looking closer on at what happens inside this MBE machine, this is the substrate, but we first need to accurately calibrate our fluxes. So we use a piezoelectric microbalance, calibrate all the individual fluxes, then heat up the single crystal substrate to a nice temperature, and then control the order in which these different molecular beams reach the substrate to build up some heterostructure. Okay. The technique itself was invented in the 60s at Bell Labs by this gentleman here, Al Cho. Not sure if anybody's heard of Bell Labs anymore, but used to be a fantastic. You've heard of Bell Labs? That's good. Go ahead. We don't focus the molecular beam. So the molecular beam, you could think of the crucible maybe as slightly focusing the molecular beam, but this flux is being radiated in all different directions. It's a very inefficient process. So to inside of this oven, so here's we call it an effusion cell, but inside of this oven is a crucible, and the crucible has a mouth on this side and then just walls on this side. So the this is emitting a molecular beam, though, much larger than the substrate here. So as in terms of efficiency, it's not a terribly efficient process. But in terms of making sharp interfaces with atomic layer abruptness and control, it's the ultimate process that's known today. And it was invented by this gentleman here, Al Cho. He's one of the few people that's still at Bell Labs. He's a retired vice president there. And here you see him in the early 70s with his first MBE machine. My university, Cornell, is very proud that they were the first university in the world to start doing molecular beam epitaxy. It's become a production technology for gallium arsenide and related compound semiconductor materials. Okay, so Alcho developed this for gallium arsenide, and that's become very active in production. 30 years ago, Jim Eckstein and I were the first to start doing oxide molecular beam epitaxy of these complex oxides, working on cuprates. And here's a look in our lab today. This is one of the molecular beam epitaxy systems. So this, the heart of it right here is this corresponds to the cartoon that I just showed you. So the sources are down here on the bottom. I know you've also seen molecular beam epitaxy from your lecture. Here's the substrate is in here. But key was 5 years ago when Kyle Shen and integrated his angle resolved photoemission system together with the MBE, making it possible to not only make these artificial heterostructures, but then look at the electronic structure. And you've heard about ARPIS, but I want to show you some results on materials that are metastable, materials that don't cleave, okay? Materials that you can tune with strain and see what the effect is by tuning on the electronic properties. So I mentioned we've been working on a lot of materials. Yesterday people were asking me, what are you doing? Okay. Well, yeah, we've been doing it all. Okay, so we've been having fun in a lot of different correlated systems. Not only the ruthenates, excitingly the cuprates, nickelates, iridates, vanadates, titanates, manganites. Okay. All these systems, heterostructures, with guidance from theory and feedback to theory. Okay, so really important team activity. I want to spend some time talking about the ruthenates here. So I showed you angle integrated, please.
So just a naive question. So is it more difficult to grow oxide than semiconductors by MBE?
Is it hard?
More difficult.
More difficult?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say yes. So I say that I started by as a PhD student doing gallium arsenide, making laser structures. And then this thing happened in 1986 when I was just starting my graduate studies, was the discovery of the cuprate superconductors. And that's what changed my life. So I knew this technique, and everybody took their technique and started working on these cuprate superconductors. So that's when Jim Eckstein and I started working on these cuprates. And at first, it was total disaster. So the first few years, we had no superconducting films. Oxide and ultra-high vacuum and hot filaments are a contradiction in terms. So we started burning up all these effusion cells. We started burning up all the hot filaments in the reactor. So it's taken a few years. But after making all mistakes possible, we've gotten better at this technique. Yeah, please.
I'm sorry, but what's T prime? La2C4 T prime?
Yeah, so this is a different structure than you might be used to for lanthanum strontium cuprate, which is the original Bednortz annular material with the Ruddleston-Popper structure. So this T-prime structure has a mixture of coordination states for the copper. So some of them are octahedrally coordinated, whereas other ones are four-planar coordinated in the structure. So this is neodymium cerium copper oxide is isostructural with this, if you know your cuprates. But we're using epitaxial stabilization to look at the effect of changing the structure that we have for this cuprate on its electronic properties. Yeah. So it's not the stable bulk phase that we're accessing here in thin film form, which makes it fun, right? So imagine taking your favorite material and tweaking it in a controlled way and watching how the electronic structure evolves. So small changes in strain, small changes in doping, to try to find a more optimal composition to get the properties that you want, or understand what's going on in the material. That gives you an idea of the. I think the traditional approach is you find this material, you characterize it, you find that material, you characterize it, you find the other material, you characterize it. But you don't get to tune the material. This approach, we can tune the material, and that's where having substrates is a key part of the approach. Okay. Antoine?
Out of curiosity, so I see you mentioned iron selenide.
Yeah, yeah.
So there is this fascinating report of
Exactly.
Is that something you've been...
Yes. So that interface that you're talking about is between, you know, one monolayer of this and strontium tightening. And there have been a lot of ideas about why it is that you get 10 times higher TC when you do this. And maybe it has something to do with the high polarizability or the phonons from the strontium titanate. Well, we work on a lot of oxides. So we work on a lot of ferroelectric oxides. And Kyle and my idea is, well, let's utilize our ability to control the polarizability of the substrate and then put the iron selenide on top of that. Correct. Yeah. So you could think of your favorite system and tweak it.
So do you confirm the high TC of iron selenide on
STO? I think the 100 Kelvin is the claim. We have not seen 100 Kelvin. But Kyle has, so he's also made an in-situ conductivity. So without even, which is key if you want to not have to cap the layer. So Kyle is now able to measure in-situ for contact, not only ARPA's in-situ, but also resistivity, four-point measurements in situ, and confirmed superconductivity. But the maximum he's seen is on the order of 60 Kelvin. And and that's all on strontium titanate. We're just getting started with playing with the underlying layer. But imagine playing the strain game, playing the polarization game, and watching the electronic structure evolve. Okay. Hopefully, whatever system you're thinking about working on, you can think of the advantages of being able to tweak it in a tunable way. So I showed you before angle-integrated barium ruthenate, but things get much more exciting when you can start to look directly at the ARPAs. So Antoine earlier on this morning drew the first Brillouin zone over here for, I guess that was strontium ruthenate, the Rellison popper. But here you can see, again, with the gamma point being here, you can see these bands. Okay, so here we have a hole pocket and electron pockets. And you can see how the dispersion is as a function of energy. Cutting through these bands. You can compare it directly to your favorite theory. And I mentioned this is strongly strained. So here's if it were cubic, here's with a tetragonal. We've also added so different functionals, adding in spin orbit. I can show you some of those cuts. This is all unpublished. So it's not, but I thought I'd give you an idea of the kind of things that Kyle's doing all the time. On these metastable structures that have been stabilized, so we do not see ferromagnetism in the structure, but these are very thin, and so the beyond 5 unit cells in thickness, it's about 2 nanometers thick, it relaxes, but under that thickness, you can see very clear the effect of thickness on the band structure, so as we go down in the number of unit cells. These are comparisons to your favorite theory, be it GGA, for example, and how it generally looks here at the Fermi surface, like a pretty good agreement, but when you start looking at these energy cuts, you can start to see a discrepancy between theory and experiment, and that's fun in these correlated systems to establish, how much the effective mass has changed. Here's again the different structures that are being calculated, different strain states. So here's an example of one of the substrates that our collaborators at the German Institute of Crystal Growth in Berlin make. That's well lattice matched to barium ruthenate. So we can look at the effect of strain on the band structure. Can look at the effect of adding in the spin orbit coupling and seeing how, and you see that there's not much difference until you get over here to the pi zero point to the Brillouin zone. But to compare, how the electronic structure code that you're using compares to actual experiment on these moderately correlated materials. Okay, I'd like to talk about Pauling's rules. So Pauling's rules, even if you haven't learned them from your crystal chemistry textbook, if you go to Wikipedia, you'll still see Pauling's rules. So here I went to Wikipedia, the ultimate source of all science known, and the little humor. The Pauling's rules, according to Wikipedia, are that the anions pack around cations in such a way that you don't have cations that are rattling around inside of a cage. Okay, that's the essence of it. And so this, which is labeled unstable, corresponds to a lot of anion repulsion. And that's why Pauling said this is, you know, unstable, whereas this is the stability limit from a energetic standpoint, and then this one would be stable. Now, when you're making thin films, you can break these rules. And let me explain how that goes on. So in bulk systems, although this might be the stability limit for your particular coordination polyhedron, imagine what happens when you have a substrate that presents the atoms that you're raining down on that substrate with different spacings. So here, in cartoon fashion, I'm showing a substrate that has a spacing where when you rain the atoms down, it would just be at this stability limit. And that stability limit would correspond, for example, to a titanium in the very center of an oxygen coordination polyhedron. So this is an octahedron around the titanium. Imagine that if you have a substrate that's slightly larger and you rain your atoms down. Now in bulk, you don't have the interfacial energy to worry about. But in thin film form, it costs energy to nucleate some other polymorph of this material. So instead what happens is that the atoms come down and they follow the underlying motif of the substrate, but this cage around the titanium has been stretched laterally. So the cage is larger in the plane, so that titanium atom is rattling around inside of its cage. And although although this violates Pauling's rules, this can be extremely useful in terms of a functional property. So when we think of ferroelectricity, and this is the essence of ferroelectricity. Here I have a titanium position that is not stable in the center of the cage. It's stable off-center from the cage. So let's look at this from an energetic standpoint. Here, where the case where this material is centrosymmetric, okay, the titanium is inside of a parabolic well, looking like this. On the other hand, if I strain the cage by providing a larger substrate, and this titanium can now rattle around inside of this cage, it has two stable positions, where it's over here bonding with these oxygens, or when it's on the right-hand side, bonding with those oxygens over there. So it gives you a double well. You can change the energetic potential that the titanium sees by playing this strain game. And that was first boldly predicted by these theorists over here. And I say boldly predicted because this has never been seen experimentally. But these theorists, using phenomenological theory, predicted what the effect of biaxial strain should be on strontium titanate. Now, strontium titanate, it's the classic perovskite that you learned about. Okay, calcium titanate is perovskite itself, but strontium titanate's a close relative that remains centrosymmetric all the way down to zero Kelvin. And in that centrosymmetric state, it can't be ferroelectric. So it's boring, I would argue, at all those temperatures. But what these bold theorists predicted and published was that by straining the material, the state should go from being paraelectric, the meaning of the subscript P here at zero strain, to ferroelectric, the meaning of that subscript F. So this phase diagram is telling you about the direction of the polarization as a function of strain, whether the polarization is in the plane or the spontaneous polarization is out of the plane. And that bold prediction with appropriate substrates is quite true. So experimentally, this is the first example of where theory changed my life. These are the results of Alex Mueller plotting what the dielectric constant of strontium titanate is as a function of temperature. And it has this huge dielectric constant at low temperature. It's on the verge of a ferroelectric transition. So he calls this an incipient ferroelectric. If you strain the strontium titanate by putting it on this substrate over here, you can bring this Curie-Weiss peak to the vicinity of room temperature. You strain it even more by putting it on that substrate over there. Now, you can not only see the Curie-Weiss peak, it's gone to above room temperature. At room temperature, you can see the hysteresis loop of the ferroelectric. Okay? So you're changing the energetic landscape, and you're revealing a hidden ground state of strontium titanate. So this is essentially different than the way that the strain game is played with semiconductors. So in modern transistors, a strain is used industrially. It's used in all your transistors that you have today to increase the mobility of the silicon, commonly by 20-30%. That's taking an existing property and improving the property. What I'm talking about is accessing a hidden ground state. It's not silicon and you're just changing its mobility. It's going from a material that is not ferroelectric at any temperature and making it ferroelectric at room temperature. So it's accessing this hidden ground state. And the same thing can be done in a magnetic version of strontium titanate, europium titanate. Mark?
Yeah, I mean, so let's say you were to take an STO film and by strain, turning it into the ferroelectric, but STO is also a superconductor.
Yes.
So could you sort of create a switch?
I think it's a fascinating question, and we haven't been able to do that yet. Now I don't want to say that it's not possible or not, but making strontium titanate superconduct is not trivial. So strontium titanate, like the superconducting strontium titanate films, took a long time to produce. And groups like Jean-Marc Triscone, who makes superconducting strontium titanate, or Harold Huang, who makes superconducting strontium titanate, if you look at the conditions at which they make those, they grow them at 1,200 degrees C. If they try growing it at lower temperature, it's not superconducting. So it's very sensitive to defects. So I think that to really answer your question, you need to play the strain game at 1,200 degrees C. Our apparatus only allows us to grow so far up to 1,000 degrees C. And one of the things that we'll be doing the next couple of years is getting laser heating so we can do MBE. Jean-Marc and Harold don't do MBE. Okay, they use a different technique, pulse laser deposition. You know, you've heard about it directly from Jean-Marc. But that is amenable to this 1,200 degree C growth temperature, which yields the superconducting strontium titanate. I would love to have superconducting strontium titanate and play the strain game. Yeah, so I think it's a great question. Other things can happen when you go to those high temperatures. You have to worry about cracking due to thermal expansion differences between the substrate and the film when you cool it down, inner diffusion. So lots of things can ruin the game. Okay, but experimentally, I think that question is still wide open. Other questions? Okay, so let's look at a magnetic version of strontium titanate. And this is europium titanate. Europium is halfway through the lanthanides. So its electron configuration is a half-filled F-shell, a 4F7 electron configuration. It's europium 2+, like strontium 2+, has this very similar size, but it's just a magnetic version, 7 Bohr magnetons in each one of those europiums. So imagine my same diagram here. And in the bulk, europium titanate orders antiferromagnetically. So it has these huge spins, 7 Bohr magnetons each on each of the europiums, but it orders as a G-type antiferromagnet. So it's antiferromagnetically ordered at the same time that it's paraelectric. So it's doubly useless. Another bold theoretical prediction here. So these bold theorists predicted that it should go from this boring ground state at zero strain to a ground state that's simultaneously ferroelectric and ferromagnetic. Now, the ferroelectricity you might expect, because it's just like strontium titanate. So I stretch this box, I violate Pauling's first rules. I start having a titanium rattle around inside the box. But why the ferromagnetism? And Craig made this beautiful figure, which I want to walk you through. So if we look at the perovskite structure, Craig has parameterized, using first principles theory, the magnetic exchange constants between the europiums. So the europiums are these blue ones with the arrows on them. And he, using first principles, calculated what the first nearest neighbor exchange interaction was, okay, and that's these numbers here, where positive corresponds to a ferromagnetic interaction, and negative corresponds to an antiferromagnetic interaction. There are 4 of these nearest neighbors, and there are 2 of those. So from the first nearest neighbor perspective, ferromagnetism wins out. He also calculated the second nearest neighbor interaction. So it's a super exchange for this oxygen here. Those constants are both positive. So far, ferromagnetism is in the lead. But it's when he gets to the third nearest neighbor interaction, which is again super exchange from this europium through this titanium to this europium, that antiferromagnetism ends up overall dominating the system. Okay? So this material is an incipient ferroelectric, but it also has this close balance between ferromagnetism and antiferromagnetism. And maybe you can already got the idea of Craig's, is, okay, let's take this titanium off center. So if you take this titanium off center, you can decrease the super exchange between these two europiums, and then the terms that dominate here become the ferromagnetic interactions. And that's what's going on here as a function of strain. So in either direction, you move the titanium off center, and this switches from being anti-ferromagnetic to ferromagnetic. And he went a step further than this. So he predicted that on the verge of this phase boundary, on either side of this phase boundary, you should be able to electrically move this titanium a little bit and change this delicate balance between anti-ferromagnetism and ferromagnetism. So what he's predicted is an insulator that you could apply a voltage to and it would stick to your refrigerator. So it's an incredible ferromagnet. I'm not talking about passing a huge amount of current through a wire. I'm talking about putting a voltage on an insulator and having it change from not sticking to your refrigerator to sticking to your refrigerator with 7-Bohr magnetons. Okay? That has not been done experimentally yet. It takes the right strain state of a substrate to be able to achieve that and films that are sufficiently insulating. Okay, but just giving you an idea of where this understanding the inner workings of the material can lead in terms of actually making things that have incredible properties. Now what we have done is these are the substrates that we've developed so far for this study, was we've looked at these europium titanate films as a function of strain state. And I'm going to show you an experimental comparison with what Craig calculated. And here you can see that the sample is not strained at all. This is a Mohg measurement, magneto optic Kerr effect. It shows no ferromagnetism. Our control samples, this sample over here, these are all grown same way, same conditions. Here's the bare substrate. But when we put the europium titanate on top of dysprosium scandate, you see that it's ferromagnetic. These SHG measurements show that it's ferroelectric at the same time. So this is the world's strongest multiferroic. It's simultaneously ferromagnetic and ferroelectric at the same time. Now, it's a triumph of theory. The unfortunate part for application is, if you can read the fine print, this is a 2 Kelvin measurement. Okay, so 2 Kelvin, 2.0 Kelvin. Okay, so this is, and above 4 Kelvin, it's no longer ordered magnetically. So we'd like to have this, at room temperature to be useful. I'd like to move next to some layered ruthenates, like we heard about this morning, strontium ruthenate and barium ruthenate. Now, barium ruthenate you didn't hear about this morning because in bulk, at atmospheric pressure, barium ruthenate has a different structure than this Ruddleston-Popper. But we can use epitaxial stabilization to stabilize barium ruthenate. So I'm going to show you a contrast of what happens to the electronic property of strontium ruthenate and barium ruthenate by epitaxially stabilizing them on different substrates of different lattice constants. So this is motivated by experimental work on strontium ruthenate, this unusual odd parity superconductor. And what was seen early on, and Anton said, all measurements possible have been made on strontium ruthenate. One of those measurements was the effect of hydrostatic pressure on the transition temperature of the superconductor. So it goes from atmospheric pressure, and as we increase the pressure experimentally, the transition temperature goes down, which is not desirable for applications. Imagine if you could apply negative pressure. So as a thought experiment, we'd like to go the other direction and move this upward. Now that could be difficult to achieve. So one way this has been done in bulk, and here I show two recent science papers from Andy McKenzie's group with Yoshimeno, who made the single crystals, is to look at the effect of strain on single crystals of strontium ruthenate. So this shows their apparatus, so a small piece of this single crystal. And on the axis here, this is zero strain over here. And here they're putting the strontium ruthenate in compression. Okay? So, and the compression is amazingly high. For a brittle ceramic, in compression, they can put this thing all the way out to 0.8% strain before it breaks. Okay, ceramics are quite brittle. You strain a ceramic in tension, it breaks quickly. Okay, and any of you that have dropped your iPhone know that quite well, ceramics and glass do not do well in tension. But this game can be played in bulk, And what Andy McKenzie showed is he can double, you know, more than double the transition temperature of the superconductor by applying uniaxial compressive strain. Okay, and his theoretical explanation of what's going on is that this gamma band, which is nicely drawn over here, gets closer to the edge of the Brillouin zone. So here it reaches this Van Hove singularity right here at their calculated value of 0.75. And they see this peak here at 0.6. Okay. And there had been thought that, you know, that the TC might go up when you have this when you get close to this Lifshitz transition. Okay. So this is what's measured experimentally. This is what's calculated to explain the result. And we wanted to look directly at this with this combination of ARPAs and MBE, where we can strain the material, and not strain the material by the small tenths of a percent that you just saw, but strain the material by percentages, like in the case of strontium titanate and europium titanate I was just showing you. So let's zoom in on this number line. Here I show all the different substrates that we have to strain these materials. This is the lattice constant of bulk strontium ruthenate. And now I'm going to start by showing you strontium ruthenate strained to the lattice constant of strontium titanate. This is strained in biaxial tension, and this first data point is strained already more than what you can put on it in bulk where it breaks. And what happens to the band structure? Well, here's that comparison. Here's unstrained strontium ruthenate, and here's strained strontium ruthenate by putting it on top of strontium titanate. So this is the film grown by MBE, looked at in situ by ARPAs, and you can clearly see how this gamma band is getting closer to the Van Hove singularity. Okay? So this amplifies what you saw from the theory, but you can see it in reality. And what I want to talk about next is going to higher strains. So from a theory perspective, this would be going through the Lifshitz transition, where I want to point out that this gamma band has gone from being an electron pocket around the gamma point to going past the Van Hove singularity, and now it's a whole pocket around the X point in the Brillouin zone, at least on the computer. And to do that, we needed to strain the material by more. And we started by straining strontium titanate, or trying to strain strontium ruthenate to these higher values of strain, but we weren't able to keep the films commensurate. So it relaxed at these high values of strain. So what we did instead was we used barium ruthenate. Barium ruthenate in this same Ruddleston-Popper structure. So on this axis, the ruthenium oxide plane is getting further and further apart along this axis, and we're going to look at the electronic structure. Okay, so this can be isostructural by using epitaxial stabilization. It's metastable normally, so that's why you don't see much work on it. So this was what I just showed you, and you can see the gamma band getting closer, and when we strain even further, you can see now that indeed the band has become a hole pocket around the X point. And if we look at these energy cuts, you can see that band going from an electron pocket here, crossing, becoming a hole pocket over there. So tweaking a material and watching its electronic structure evolve in a very interesting system. Now, to date, our films do not superconduct. So it'd be very nice. We would love to know what the effect of the strain is on the superconductivity. I showed you Andy McKenzie with uniaxial compression on the crystals, you know, more than doubling the superconducting transition temperature. And our my theory colleagues at Cornell have predicted the effect of strain on some units here that only a theorist could love. But they tell me that this is somehow relates to the superconducting transition temperature of the material. So the effect that they're predicting here is that the transition temperature should go up in the vicinity of the Van Hove singularity, and we would like to see that experimentally as we tune the material to these substrates. So we're working hard on making our films clean enough that they superconduct.
So there are the reasons why it's apparently kind of tough to get the films to be superconducting. Is a question of disorder.
Correct. Yes. Absolutely. So not only chemical disorder, but also structural disorder. So we use the purity of all of our chemicals is more than 4 nines. So I'm not worried about the chemical disorder, but structural disorder, having stacking faults in our films. And we can see these by TEM. I didn't bring any into the talk, but you imagine trying to grow one of these layered perovskites on top of a perovskite substrate. The out-of-plane lattice constant of these layered perovskites is different than the out-of-plane lattice constants of the perovskite substrate. So substrates have steps in them, and if you have nucleation of a layered perovskite on this step, and then you have nucleation on this step, when these two grow together, these things can be out of phase. So the ruthenium oxide layers are not continuous. And we can see those by TEM. And in fact, the distance, the in-plane coherence length is about 600 angstroms for strontium ruthenate. The distance between our defects has been less than 600 angstroms in our films. There are films out there from Kawasaki's group that do superconduct at about 0.6 Kelvin. And they did TEM on their films, and they see that their films have less structural disorder than ours, and that explains the superconductivity. So we're working, and I think this is, again, where higher substrate temperature will really make a difference. So I'm yeah.
So question?
Please.
Yeah. So as you push this system close to this Lucas transition,
yeah.
Imagine if there would be any change in the symmetry of the unit cell, would you notice it?
I think so. In fact, I think you can see that. So the can you see these shadow bands here? And they're absent over here? So this is, well, this is actually a surface reconstruction that's absent over there. So the symmetry is has an effect on the band structure that you see. Okay. Do you have a particular expectation? Okay. And how much is the distortion? Would it be easy to pick up by diffraction?
This, I cannot tell you.
Is there a calculation?
There are certainly toy calculations.
Yeah, cool. I guess there's two complications. One is we have a substrate that this whole thing is clamped to.
Yeah.
So in our case of epitaxial stabilization, and in truth, our substrates that I'm showing you here are not square. They're rectangular to begin with. So both of the gadolinium scandate and dysprosium scandate that I showed you on the right-hand side are already rectangular distortions. Okay. We're working on substrates that are cubic at these larger lattice constants to play this game. We already have rectangular distortion. Correct. It's slight. So dysprosium scandate, it's a thousandth of an angstrom longer in one axis than the perpendicular axis. Okay. But I think that's a great example of where if you have a theoretical idea, you can calculate the band structure and we can compare it directly to what the angle resolved photo emission is.
Is there a question on superconduction theorem? When you have the stacking faults come from, you mentioned that you have terraces on the substrate.
Yeah.
Can you grow first substrate on a substrate, I mean the same, and then you would put your...
Yeah. So you want to make a Ruddleston-Popper buffer layer on top of the substrate. Mm-hmm. And I think you're suggesting you really want to make that Ruddleston-Popper buffer layer.
Some, I don't know, this gadolinium thing on top of gadolinium thing.
Yeah?
Just to get something that is atomically flat and then...
No, it still has steps.
It still has steps,
yeah, correct.
You can't stop it.
So you normally try to make your substrate as accurately cut as possible. And then you take it to high temperature to try to drive your steps far apart.
Mm-hmm.
But high temperatures really help this process. Yeah. It's an interesting experimental challenge, yeah. But I'm confident. The fact that Kawasaki was able to make superconducting films, I'm confident that we should be able to do it too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
please. These are about 20, in both cases, I think they're about 20 nanometers thick. Yeah. So this number that you see here for strain, this is the strain that would be on just the ruthenium oxide layer. because this has become barium ruthenite, the strain involved is actually much lower. So the critical thickness is now, you know, 100 nanometers for this for the system. Yeah.
Just a comment. What if you rotate, for example, your substrate during the MDA
growth?
Yeah.
Yeah, we commonly do.
You still rotate?
Yeah, yeah. Commonly. Yeah. So the it depends if you want good uniformity or not. Mm-hmm. Usually we want good uniformity. So when I say good uniformity, if we rotate the substrate, the composition will be within 1% across the entire 3-inch substrate. So if you don't rotate the substrate, you can have compositional variation of 50% from one side to the other. So it depends upon what we're trying to do. Sometimes we want to deliberately do sort of a combinatorial experiment. We don't rotate the substrate, and then we can measure the properties as a function of position. Okay. So calcium ruthenate, right? Done barium ruthenate, strontium ruthenate, calcium ruthenate. Calcium ruthenate has this very interesting metal insulator transition that you heard of from Professor George. And here I show it. I show bulk measurements. So here's calcium ruthenate, this one up here. And you can see that it has this metal to insulator transition, a little bit above room temperature. Dimensionality makes a big effect. So instead of having the 214 structure, we go to the 327 structure. This transition goes way down in temperature. Here you see the effect of hydrostatic pressure on that transition. So with hydrostatic pressure, a dramatic change. So along the these are along different axes. But along one axis, it changes by 2 orders of magnitude, and along the other axis, it changes by 4 orders of magnitude with pressure. And most interestingly, this is these are all works of Yoshimeno. This most interesting recent work, they flow current through the sample. And this is not this is not a typo. Notice the electric fields are minuscule, and the material undergoes, again, this metal insulator transition. So the material that's on the verge of this very interesting metal to insulator transition, which could have practical applications. So structurally, the high temperature metallic versus the low temperature insulating structures are shown here. And there's a huge change in the shape of this octahedron. So notice in how flattened this octahedron is versus how pointed this octahedron is. And even the lattice constants are changing by several percent in both C and out of plane and as well as in plane. So it's a huge structural transition. This is X-ray diffraction taken while they pass current through the sample. So it goes from this insulating state, and you can see on the diffractometer when it goes into the metallic state like this. So it's a beautiful phase transition that can be accessed in many ways. And Andy Millis has been looking at this, and this you might suspect it already from the huge structural transition, you know, the huge strains involved in this phase transition. It's incredibly sensitive to strain. So it's, to my knowledge, it has the largest strain coefficient of any known material. So what Andy calculates here is how much this metal insulator transition should change as a function of strain. So, you know, it's a huge this is a huge amount per strain. Okay. So we've been working on looking at what the effect of strain is on this material. So I showed you this bulk result right here. Our thin films of calcium ruthenate, we strain them by 0.3%, and it shifts this transition by over 200 degrees C. So it becomes higher than our measurement. So it's shifted from here to above 650 Kelvin. We strain it in the opposite direction by putting it on lanthanum aluminate here. And you can see now it's metallic to lower temperature. So huge effect of strain on that transition. Electrically, we can indeed pass current through our samples and actuate this transition, shattering our film samples, or cracking them because they're clamped to the substrate. Here you can see this as a function of strain on different substrates. So I showed you this one that remains in the insulating state. This one's metallic to lower temperature. And then this one, by even more strain, we can keep it to metallic to low temperature. And this at first made us very excited when we saw this nice drop here. But it's been confirmed by Aaron Kapitolnik's group using a very sensitive magnetometer that this is a ferromagnetic transition. That's also been seen in bulk. So this is hydrostatic pressure as opposed to our biaxial. But in these measurements from Mano's group, they also see ferromagnetism at low temperature and precipitous drops here in resistivity. Okay, but a very interesting material. Now I want to end with a material that is the strongest ferromagnetic ferroelectric at room temperature. And that's a material that's a little bit different. So it's an iron-based system rather than a ruthenium-based system. And it's in a class of multiferroics at room temperature. And I want to start by mentioning what materials are also multiferroic at room temperature. Here I've listed them all, actually. These are all the materials that are known to be multiferroic at room temperature. The list is rather small. And what I should point out is that actually these bottom three are all too leaky to even be switched electrically. So the only material that is simultaneously magnetically ordered and ferroelectric at room temperature that can be switched electrically is this material, bismuth ferrite. Okay, hopefully you've all heard of bismuth ferrite. I don't think I've seen it in the lectures yet. Okay, but for applications, this is a very interesting material. It's a very strong ferroelectric. It has the highest spontaneous polarization of any ferroelectric material known. It orders anti-ferromagnetically, though, so it's a very wimpy magnetic system, as are all these other systems. So you can see, and what we'd like is strong ferromagnetism at the same time that we have this ferroelectricity, and we'd like them coupled at room temperature. No, okay. Okay, so basically this landscape is pretty small today. I'm going to show you doubling this landscape, so a new material that's magnetically ordered and strong. Yeah. Yes.
Because the presence of an electron prevents the distortion to happen. And that's conventionally discussed to explain why most ferroelectrics are D0 empty shells. So what makes this guy escape that?
It's on the A site, the distortion, the lone pair.
Ah, okay.
The lone pair, exactly. Yep, that is key.
So it's the
exactly. And actually the mechanism that we're utilizing here is not so very different. This is called a geometric ferroelectric system. And so this system that I'm going to be talking about is an iron oxide with lutetium in it. Okay, so here's the structure. And this is really breaking the rules already. This structure, you see lutetium, iron, oxygen, and if you're a perovskite aficionado, you might say, well, the ground state of that is centrosymmetric and it forms the perovskite structure. And that is true. That is the ground state. But what I'm starting with over here is not the ground state of the structure. This is a metastable polymorph that's epitaxially stabilized by growing it on cubic zirconia. And when it's grown on cubic zirconia, it forms what was a metastable polymorph that has the same structure as yttrium manganite, which you heard about in the first lecture from Professor George. And I'll remind you of that in just a second. But it's a geometric ferroelectric, meaning that this is real data, this is TEM over here. These bright atoms are the lutetiums. And if you notice, they're not flat. So the lutetiums are two up and one down, two up and one down. And they're charged. So that gives rise to a net polarization upward in this sample. And by applying an electric field, you can switch that pattern to be two down and one up, and two down and one up. And that would correspond to flipping the polarization by 180 degrees. Okay, so it's a ferroelectric and a geometric ferroelectric. If we look at the electron configuration of the iron, this is iron 3+, so that's a D5 configuration. And here I show the filling of the D manifold. And you might look at this and go, well, you're crazy. You know, where's T2G? And I want to emphasize that the structure I'm showing you is not the perovskite with octahedral coordination, the T2G over here. Instead, what I'm showing you is the effect of a different coordination environment. So this was lecture number two. Okay, so here we have this trigonal bipyramid. So this is the iron that I'm talking about with these three oxygens around it. And so this is now the electron configuration for the splitting of the D shells. Okay, so going back here, this coordination polyhedra is a trigonal bipyramid. So this is a triangle with oxygens top and bottom. Okay, so here's the electron configuration. So I have the five Bohr magnetons here, but this is a classic triangular lattice frustrated magnetism problem. So what I get is this anti-ferromagnetic, you know, the spins all can't out. This is a top view here, okay, side view here. So this is a frustrated magnetic system, highly frustrated. So in both, this material is at room temperature, it's paramagnetic, but at low temperature, it orders anti-ferromagnetically, but it's a robust ferroelectric to very high temperatures. In fact, you've seen this ferroelectricity. This is from lecture number one. Here I show holmium manganite, okay? It's the same deal. There are two downs and one up, okay? But at any rate, it can be switched the other way. So it's a geometric ferroelectric, same kind of system going on as what I just showed you. Now, so that's a ferroelectric system, robust ferroelectric, but magnetically highly frustrated. It has a close brother, lutetium iron oxide, that has a slightly different structure. So this is the, see you, Mark. I'm almost done. The double layer here is a double layer of iron oxide, okay? And the stoichiometry now has a mixture of iron 2 plus and iron 3 plus. So here I've shown the electron configurations, a D5 system and a D6 system over here. This material is a robust ferrimagnet, but it's not polar at all. Notice how flat these lutetium oxide layers are. Okay? They're totally flat. So this now has mere symmetry. The polarization has been destroyed. There's no longer a polarization going up or down. Okay? So on their own, both of these materials have only one property, but not the combination of properties. And our idea was, hey, let's bring these together. And I'll show you more about that in just a second. But let's look at a top view of the charge-ordered version that can be seen in theory. This is a side view, but this is a top view. And look at this is this 120-degree angle between the iron, oxygen, iron. This is iron 3 plus, oxygen 3 plus. This is iron 2 plus, oxygen 2 plus. But they're both 120 degrees in this highly frustrated system. Okay. Now, in the computer, I've been talking about the ground state over here. But in the computer, you can calculate, Craig can calculate, all the other hidden ground states in the system. Okay? And to me, this is a beautiful example of close by in energy ground states that have much different properties. So there's charge ordering here, but Craig has ordered these in two different ways. Above the number line, and this is energy, energy is this axis. So this is the ground state according to DFT. Above the number line, all of these are centrosymmetric. So these are not ferroelectric. In fact, you can see that by this lutetium layer is totally flat. They all have mirror symmetry. Below the number line, you see this puckering, this geometric ferroelectricity that gives rise to a polarization that's out of plane. Okay. In addition, calculating the magnetism here, the ground state here is this ferrimagnet. Okay, it's this frustrated system, but it's in total, there is a net spontaneous magnetization of about a half a Bohr magneton per iron. And the computer close by in energy, you can see this is just 4 millielectron volts per formula unit. So very close by. You know, Craig would argue this is his errors of DFT are larger than these the spacings here. But notice this phase in particular is simultaneously ferroelectric and also has a significant magnetization. And there are many, you know, many other phases. So when you see this and you think of those hidden ground states and which one you'd like to target, this is the hidden ground state that we would love to target. It has simultaneously has lots of magnetism at the same time that it has polarization. And these are the kind of experiments you can do on the computer. You can look at what the effect of this distortion is, the puckering of this lutetium oxide on the iron oxide double layer. And what Craig gets on the computer is that as he distorts that layer, that his an Ising model of the temperature of the transition goes up, the temperature of the transition goes up as he distorts this layer more and more. So as he increases the distortion of this layer, the transition temperature gets higher and higher. Okay, so we so from a design principle, we would like to deliberately pucker this layer. We deliberately like to have this puckering layer right next to this double layer of iron oxide. Okay. And what he sees in the computer again is when you pucker this layer, it changes the angles from being 120 degrees between the iron 3+, to being closer to 180. So this is going to favor, by good enough Kanamori rules, anti-ferromagnetic coupling. Whereas the iron 2+, gets closer to 90 degrees, which favors ferromagnetic coupling between them in the plane. Okay. And now before our work, I went to the literature searching for known compounds that kind of follow this design principle. Here's a bulk compound that is a superlattice that is an ordered superlattice that occurs in nature between one of these single layer and one of these double layer. And this was studied back in the 80s in bulk by the same Japanese group, and I've rescaled their figures of magnetization next to each other. And I want to point out a very unusual feature. These were measured by the same group in the same field. Notice how this transition seems to be at a higher temperature than that transition, okay? Which would be, in analog to this thing. You want to distort those planes. When you have the puckering, it reduces the frustration, which increases the transition temperature of the magnetism. Okay. So we set about making these as superlattices, and I'm going to show you superlattices between these two end members. This is the ferroelectric end member. This is the ferrimagnetic end member, and these superlattices are all varying the number of the ferroelectric. So here's two of the single layer and then a double layer of iron. Okay, here's nine of the single layer and then a double layer of iron. And what you can see already from the TEM image is how we've achieved this puckering right next to the double iron oxide layer. This has no puckering at all. This is a completely flat layer. This has mirror symmetry, no polarization. And what we see from the magnetic properties is on our films, this one orders at low temperature. This one orders at high temperature, but the very highest temperature for the ordering occurs intermediate in this superlattice. So it's a very interesting mixing rule, which at first really puzzled us, but from Craig's explanation, what we're doing is we're reducing the frustration in these iron oxide layers, and by reducing their frustration, their magnetic transition goes to higher temperature, which is what we want. Okay, so if my message wasn't clear, what we're doing is combining a material that's centrosymmetric, like this, okay, but has ferrimagnetism, with a material that has this puckering, and by putting the two together, we reduce the frustration on this double layer of oxygen. Okay, this is all real data that I'm showing you by TEM. Now I was extracting the magnetic transition temperature. I want to show you the raw squid results. This is the magnetization on the pure N member that has a single iron oxide layer. This is the pure N member that has a double iron oxide layer. And when we make these superlattices, no matter how you define TC, it goes up, okay? That's the point. and that's a very strange mixing rule. In fact, if you apply a magnetic field and look at the saturation magnetization, there is a saturation magnetization even at room temperature in this structure. Okay? So it becomes magnetically ordered with ferrimagnetic ordering at room temperature at the same time that it's ferroelectric. Now the most exciting part of this is not only is it multiferroic, but the two are coupled. So Ramesh at Berkeley used an AFM to electrically pull the ferroelectric, and then a week later took it to the spin pole, the PEEM, so magneto-optic Kerr effect, that's resolved on a small length scale here of several microns, and can see that the electric writing affected the magnetism. So there's a coupling between applying an electric field and the magnetization of the material. So it's a coupled multiferroic, and that coupling was written at room temperature. An important aspect of this, which maybe for reasons of time I'll skip, was you might wonder if it's just electrochemistry that's going on. We do not see that in the sample. So in summary, let me summarize that I've shown you an example of a system where theory in combination with experiment can be used to target these hidden ground states and make materials that have properties that are better than any known. I've shown you that in the case of this room temperature multiferroic. I showed you this case of the strongest multiferroic at low temperature. And in conclusion, I just like to say that thin film alchemy, in my view, is a great way to tweak materials. And I think this combination of theory and experiment can be used to understand materials better and make them have better properties. Thank you very much.